The Process, a podcast about creativity and experimental music. In the world of experimental music, outcomes and accolades for creators can be uncertain and at times seem far and few between. Therefore, creators and practitioners of experimental music must embrace the one thing they will always have complete control over, the process. This podcast aims to understand this creative process by listening to new works and discussing them with their creators. Each episode focuses on one creator and their music. Understanding how and why they create can inform aspiring creatives and help audiences better understand and navigate experimental music. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and I'll be your host as we explore the world of experimental music, creativity, and the human need to find purpose in their world and lives. This is The Process. Welcome back to another episode of The Process. You may hear a little bit of raining in the background here. It's the Northeast and it's the summer, so apparently rain is the dominant weather feature of 2023. So apologies in advance for the sort of dulcet shimmering of water on the eaves. Today, we will be listening to Hearing Landscapes, Hearing Icescapes, a new focus recordings release by the really great composer Lei Liang. Today, we're specifically going to focus on Hearing Icescapes, which constitutes tracks 4 and 5 of the album. Specifically, we'll listen to Part 2, which is subtitled Part 2 Response. Two of the takeaways I had from our conversation today is this idea of call and response, and then also just this idea of listening as a skill. So let me start with the latter. Listening as a skill, it's interesting. You know, when I was in grad school, I remember talking to one of my professors, and he mentioned this idea. He's like, well, you know, you'll figure it out. You're a musician. And at the time, I was like, of course, yes. At that point, I had a bachelor's in music, and I was like, yes, you're right. Actually, I have this training in music, and as years go on and as time has gone on, jaded is not the right word, but we become a little bit downtrodden sometimes with this idea of sort of devaluing the skill of musicianship or what it means to be a trained musician. And Lei sort of reminded me of, oh no, listening, that's a skill that I have. And so I can identify, the subject in a fugue or whatever. Maybe that's a little bit very specific to music, but just this idea that science and some of the interdisciplinary work or multidisciplinary work he's been doing for this album and as part of his research, listening is a really important part in some of these experiments, these scientific experiments, but also in the data collection itself. And part of the way to interpret the data is to listen. So being a trained listener is an actual skill. That still doesn't mean I'm going to listen to advice from colleagues and previous teachers, but I do have the skill, I do have the ability to do so if I choose to. The other point was call and response, and I'll let Lei explain this more to us, but this idea that the response is where the rich data is. Let's start this off, though, by listening to Hearing Icescapes, Part 2 Response, from Lei Liang's Hearing Landscapes, Hearing Icescapes, on New Focus Recordings. Thank you.
Yeah, well, this project really comes about when I was a composer in residence at Qualcomm Institute at UC San Diego. So this is a very special place. Qualcomm Institute being a kind of a telecommunication center, sure. An artist being in that environment, I could have just composed the kind of music I usually do. But I thought being where I am in my life, in my career, I felt the best thing that could ever happen to me is becoming a student again, right? And this is the perfect place to do it, because with all these people in engineering and the technology is a big thing there, and also medical research, I just find this to be the perfect environment where I can really learn again and learn how to listen, learn how to acquire new tools and think differently, right? So I just require myself to be truly in residence there. The office should not be a storage. It should be like where I live. I was there, and that really changed how I composed very profoundly. So this particular album covers 10 years of work, starting with the first piece. I imagined a different way of listening with a group of engineers. And that was really kind of the thing that laid the foundation for all kind of research that I did ever since. I realized my team was no longer consisted of just musicians, composers, but also material scientists, data scientists, and robotic engineers, and also sound designers, and especially software designers.
So you mentioned that they would be listening in different ways. Is that kind of what you said? So what were some of the different ways they would be listening? Or you said you now have, audience is not the word you use, but you said they're going to be attracted to different things in music. Is that what you were suggesting? Or listening for different things?
Well, I think what's most interesting for me to discover was that so many different disciplines outside of music gravitate towards listening. And that is something that was really, really interesting for me. Yeah. Me being somebody who has been trained in classical music, coming out of an experience of writing for orchestra, chamber music, electronics, those things, that was a kind of work way of engaging with music making and finding, evoking identity, sense of belonging, all of those things. But now in this place, we're listening to, for example, ice. And not only that I was fascinated with the ice, but also these engineers and oceanographers teach me how to listen to them in a different way and why this is important to them. Just to start with, I mean, this recording came from a very ingenious design of recording ice at a place that is the most inaccessible to human. This is in the Arctic. And the way that this recording was made was not somebody who was trying to chase the mammals and
chasing an iceberg.
Get lucky, right? I mean, that has been done a lot. Sure. But the oceanographers on this team, based at Scripps Institution of Oceanography here at UCSD. By the way, that is the institute, the founder of it, Roger Revelle, was one of the first to cover global warming. Yeah. It's a very, very interesting place. And what they do is that they place the hydrophones 300 meters below sea surface, right at this spot that you see my screenshot here. So what we can do with all this new technology is that we understand where sound comes from, how sound is made, and why sound is important. The way that we can experience the sound, first of all, we can place our ears 300 meters below sea surface at a place that is completely inaccessible to human.
Right.
Then we can also place our eyes 400 miles above the sea surface and to experience this part of the world, both seeing it and hearing it. And what struck me first was so interesting, not only that these sounds are very special, they're very precious for us because we could never hear these sounds if it was not for this team of oceanographers. But also what sound means to people who are, the Inuits who live in the Arctic. They experience their living environment by listening. Seasons are not demarcated by a fixed calendar. For them, it's listening to the changing conditions in the environment. When you hear the footstep of polar bears, that's the beginning of a season. In fact, that's more precise, right? It's not just a fixed date because our environment's changing.
Right, and often the norms of like spring starts on a specific arbitrary date and it's still cold or the temperature hasn't quite changed. Sometimes it's a weak flex here or there. So when is it really hunting season, or when is it really, you know, time to, you know, harvest or hunt or, yeah.
Yes. It's a culture that is so rich with listening to the environment. And so what we found is that in the process of getting this data, this is an enormous amount of data because we're talking about a hydrophone recording 24/7 throughout the entire year. And then when the conditions allow, the icebreaker will go to the same spot, pick up the hydrophone, send it back to the lab, and then restore the data to a possible, you know, you can hear it again. Then our work begins there, because we're going to, it's kind of like discovering that beautiful sculpture hidden inside of a marble. There's a lot of noise when you first get it. The ocean has all kind of noise. You have to understand what those are and what you're looking for, differentiate it from everything else. But also you have to be aware of the noise that's made by the computer itself,
right?
The self-generator, the generator and all of that.
Right. Or even the microphone itself. It's the characteristics of the microphone, and it's
cables, right? All of that is there. Yeah. So we have, it's a very laborious process to clean up, let's call it, with the scientists. But Doc, I learned so much in that process. I wouldn't trade it for anything else because we can't just let a machine do that. Yeah. This is when the good training we have with music really comes to help us. You know, with the scientists, we understand what we're listening for. What we used to describe as noise, they're not noise at all. They are very, very important information for us. And one of the things I realized that was the most striking is that if we just talk about ice alone, we as musicians, when we hear it, maybe we just like it because it has a beautiful texture.
Sure.
It has an interesting popping sound or something.
Right.
Density. Maybe those are the words we describe it. But when you're working with these oceanographers, your vocabulary change. You hear the air pressure. Mm-hmm. You hear the density because of the thickness of the ice. Mm-hmm. You start to hear the hardness of the ice. You start to hear time, you know, which year, which month, even which week you will hear this kind of ice. For example, the beginning of the piece, you hear the birth of ice. That you can only hear in the first 3 days when the ice start to form again.
Yeah.
Or, of course, all kind of movements that make particular ice sound that we didn't even know existed because, you know, they sound like all kind of things, but we wouldn't associate with ice. So it's a beautiful learning process that I feel I was trained to hear this in a very, very different way. Mm-hmm. And because of how much effort we put into this, this project took about 4 or 5 years for us to, especially the pandemic, you know, the 3 years of being locked down. This is the one thing that kind of held us together because I was still having weekly meetings on Zoom and we were cleaning these files. We call it cleaning the files, removing the cable sound, removing the battery sound, you know, layer by layer, very, very slowly. But every week we look forward to this meeting, my team together with the oceanographer. That was just beautiful. It was such a, it was like a sanctuary for us that this is where we can recharge ourselves.
we have all this data, and you have this wonderful research that you're doing with your very multidisciplinary group. So how do we then go from there and from that work into basically this composition, this quote unquote music? And how did we get there? And I believe there's instrumentalists involved. There's, yes. I believe there's a trumpet, violin, and flute.
Flute, yes.
So how do we go from this rich data coming from ice miles under the, under the surface to writing music for violin?
Well, I got to tell you, it evolved so organically. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I thought this was a chance for me to challenge myself. One of the first things I wanted to do is to interpret this data in a way that can create a beautiful experience all just on its own. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time animate these sounds. For example, the eyes. We already talked about that a little bit. Also, the marine mammal sounds, you know, when the season arrives, the migration starts, the first thing you hear is the bearded seals, for example. And this is when I engage in with technology in a way that is very creative. I wanted to create, for example, the sound of a chorus of seals singing. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really captured by the hydrophones. There's nothing quite like it. Mm-hmm. And my dear friend, Josh Jones, he's been doing this for years. He has never heard a bearded seal chorus captured with all those data they have already preserved. But I made them by using the software that was developed by our team. Mm-hmm. The beautiful thing is, Doug, it was, I believe, 3 months ago when Josh received another set of data that was captured in a different location in the Arctic. They have several different deployments. He sent me on a Sunday morning, said, "Lay, listen to this." And it was a chorus of bearded seals that sound very much like what we did. So in a way, our research kind of foreshadowed what was there, or, you know, it was a beautiful kind of a convergence of these images that we already have in our mind. Very, very interesting moment. But once we finished creating these, can call it soundscape. By the way, you can already tell that by the way I'm describing how I work, I'm not presenting this like a music concrete or something, or just listening. It's not enough. I think that there's so much we need to do. It's highly selective. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very engaged in the process. So what you hear is not what is just being captured with microphone. Actually recreated throughout a very subtle but creative process. Mm-hmm. And then I took it to these wonderful musicians without knowing what to expect, because I felt that one of the things that could be very fun for me to do is to kind of create an orchestration lab. You know, we teach orchestration. We know how to, you know, we write for orchestra. But I've always resisted of, you know, the idea of teaching an orchestration class, because that always makes me feel like doing something that I already know.
Sure.
But an orchestration lab is more interesting. And what I did was simply playing these sounds completely unprepared for my listeners. And in this case, for example, I invited the flutist, Teresa, or the violinist, Mira, and trumpet player, David, individually to my studio. And I said, "I just have something I want to play for you. And I want to see their reaction." And that was very touching. It was very, very touching. This was right after, you know, the pandemic finished and people were coming back to campus. We're still wearing masks, but we were sitting in the lab. And I was I was so moved by the way they listened.
Yeah.
I remember their posture, how much they were drawn into it. There were moments that it was speechless. We were just completely enthralled. Mm-hmm. And that gave me hope. I thought, you know what? This could be really interesting if these three wonderful performers, if we kind of get ourselves into a recording studio, it could be very interesting. And Doug, this is... Mm-hmm. What is the next thing that was so interesting? Yeah. Not only that we record music, or we do that all the time, but how about having an oceanographer in that mix?
Huh.
That was so interesting.
Now, let me ask you that. So So does Dr. Jones then, would he say, like, let's take it again from bar 52? Or
was it, that part is more like what I would say.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What Dr. Jones was saying is that when he heard it, he was making these comments that were so touching for us because he was moved. He was in tears when he first heard it. For example, one of the things that the Brutus simply felt compelled to do was to making an air sound, was to make an air sound,
right.
Kind of a whistling sound.
Yeah.
While she was listening to the eye sound of all these pops. It's, I think part of this, what we are training for, you know, we're training counterpoint, you know, we think, okay, when there's a lot of pops, I give you some sustained sound, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And what Josh heard was that that sounded exactly like the things that he was missing because the data was so, so clean that all of that, what we might describe as noise, but what it really is ambient sound, were removed, you know?
Yeah.
But when Teresa did that, she even, you know, subconsciously, she kind of restored it for us. Mm-hmm. And Josh been craving for that sound. And so when that happened, he was in tears and he was sharing this with the player and the players heard and the player was in tears. So it was like, all these amazing communication, and this happened with the violinist Mira, and also with the trumpet player David. So it was like one of the most interesting rehearsal sessions I had because I was able to invite an oceanographer into the mix and have this dialogue. It was just beautiful.
I love this idea of, you know, because call and response is a musical phrase as well, but, you know, with like echolocation, you're sending out a very sort of sometimes pure signal, but the meaning is in what comes back and in the response. And I love this idea of that, you know, it's call and response. I think there's often this idea that there's this similar hierarchy in that you send out a message and you receive a similar message, but perhaps what you're suggesting is that, you know, maybe the call is a much simpler kind of prompt and then the meaning is in the response.
Right. It's kind of like I feel, at least this allows me to think this as a very important, it's sort of the core of communication.
Right.
You know, we are talking and we're in the same wavelength. It's because of the added personal information to that line of questioning, to that line of thought, that make this communication so meaningful. And I think that's what, you know, again, I'm using that as a metaphor. I think that's what some of these mammals depend on is that they want to hear that added information compared to the original. So that's what gives them meaning, you know, and that's where communication lies, right? So, and I when we think about that as, you know, a kind of umbrella concept for a lot of things that we do, it's actually quite useful too.
Then it just reminds us how important it is to send the call out too, is to keep communicating and keep sending the call out so that we can get some responses or some meaning. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, one of the things that I really found interesting, especially about the part two of Icecapes is that there were moments of nothing, just silence, nothing happening. And there was just moments of stoppage, of rest.
Yeah, you know, we are all trained by the music we learn to listen to silence, right? The silence in Webern, the silence in Haydn, and all these things. And what they mean,
strike the whole piece of silence if we go to Cage.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. This is a silence that takes us to a different realm. I realized that some of the silence is made by the complete breathing of the sea surface. You no longer have any access to breathe, you know, and that's why the animals have to move out. they will have no place to breathe, right?
Right.
There's that. And also there's like very, very subtle kind of silence that when I listen to it, I couldn't help but thinking, what does it really mean to breathe for these marine mammals? You know, you think about the breathing cycles and it's so different from human, right? So we're breathing in a way that's related to our heartbeat and all that, right? And you start to think, okay, if the bearded seal, which is also featured quite prominently in this piece, especially that moment when they start to migrate, if they can sing phrases like that, it really means that they have a very, very different kind of capacity for breathing, right?
Right, right.
And that changes the way we experience phrases. It changes the way we perceive time, and certainly changed the way we kind of pace ourselves in terms of silence. You know, what is the moment, how long you take to breathe in? When we breathe in, you know, for us, it's the moment of silence. When we breathe out, either, you know, a wind instrument or something, when we talk, that's the sound, right? There's always a kind of interesting dialectics between these two. But
if the breathing in lasted for 10 minutes, then it would be a much more significant thing to us. So in the piece, those periods of silence is just a longer breath.
That's right. The vastness of that kind of space. And I, my friend Josh is somebody who has spent so much time, so much of his life on the ocean, right? And and hearing whales approach you and the time it takes to approach you is one of the most magnificent things you can experience. You know, I'm not doing that in this piece, but I was informed by that. I couldn't help but thinking about these questions.
Right.
Just what does it mean when we have to think about time completely differently? And also, what does it really mean to create something that make us feel that we're in a different medium? You know, that this is not sound heard in the air, but also it's water. That's a very, very different medium. So in a way, it's probably a more powerful medium.
And it could be traveling from miles away, like further than we could see. And
that's right. Well, kilometers. I mean, we're talking about large groups of animals knowing each other's presence, but there's no way they can see each other. And they are all connected by sounds. It's really incredible. Think about that. And when we hear a moment, it's not just, you know, the sound that we can hear on land. We're connected by sounds that were sent to us from very, very far away, because this is what it takes for that sound to reach here.
Right.
And we have the sound of the present. So in ocean, you're hearing the past and the present all mixed together in a very different way. It's not just a pedal on the piano, you know?
Right. Well, we're about out of time. This has been a fantastic conversation. I think I'll take away from this my appreciation for listening, beyond just for I listen for enjoyment, but there's so many other things that I could probably unlock by listening and having skills in listening.
That's right.
Before I let you go, tell us where we can go to find out more about the album and just more about you and your music in general.
Oh, yeah. So, yes, I have a personal website. It's not hard to Google me and just pull it up. One place that could be interesting in particular is that I just launched a lab here at UCSD, Qualcomm Institute. So it's called Lei Lab. If you look for Lei, that's my name, L-E-I, Lab, and UCSD, you will find it. And here you can meet all of our members of the team who made this possible. And you will see, you know, from oceanographer, geologists, engineers, to software developers. And this is really kind of an environment that we created. I kind of think of it as an ecosystem, that we create this ecosystem where we can actually be creative in a kind of unconventional way. And so far, this kind of has become my family. We love working together. It's been really, really fun. And I'm sure there will be some other things that could be cool to listen to.
Thanks to Lay for sharing his time and music with us. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, please check out other episodes in the series. And as always, like, subscribe, or leave a comment on your preferred podcasting app. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and this has been The Process.